Good morning, everybody. Hope everybody's well. Thank you for coming. A reminder about phones. Please turn your phones off. Even though we say this every week, there's always a little jingle somehow in the shirt, so please turn them down to silent. As promised, we are turning our minds to matters mystical. It's about time. We haven't, in 131 shiurim, we haven't turned our minds to this. And since I am over the age of 40, just about, actually quite a long way, then I think it's not a bad thing for us to think about this a little bit. This actually is a topic which I'm very personally interested in, halachic process and the extent to which different influences impact on halacha. And in this particular series, we're going to look at some Kabbalistic issues, some mystical issues, and really ask the question as to what extent should Kabbalah, can Kabbalah, does Kabbalah have an impact on the regular halachic process? We live in a world which is, well, has for the last 600 years been pretty mystical in orientation. The Hasidim are Kabbalistic, the Sephardim are Kabbalistic these days, didn't used to be back in the Middle Ages, but definitely are today, or they didn't all used to be. The Lithuanians are Kabbalistic, the Vilna Gaon, the Yeshiva world is based on Nefesh HaChaim, a world of Kabbalah. And we have a few questions to ask, and I've formulated some of them at the beginning here. Does Kabbalah have a role in halachic psak, like I said? In the event of a conflict between classic sources and mystical sources, which wins? Which is going to be primary? Is there any benefit to adopting Kabbalistic practices when they don't conflict with classic halakha? Every now and then this can blow up in people's faces. I'll give you an example. Every now and then women go to a funeral and are told by the Chevron Kedisha women can't come onto the cemetery. And people say, why not? We grew up here and women always came, and this can obviously be very emotive at an extremely sensitive time. And what you're seeing there is the impact of Kabbalistic or mystical ideas coming into conflict a little bit there with classic or non-Kabbalistic ideas. And that's just one example. We'll talk about many. Do the commentators in the world of Kabbalah have a higher status because they're Kabbalists in halacha? Or the same status? Or a lower status because Kabbalah is not meant to be part of Tzak? Should we just take Kabbalah out completely from the world of halacha without any denigration or belittling chas v'shalom of the world of mystical thought? It has its own place. The world of Kabbalah has its own place in Kabbalistic mystical ideas. It's a machshava idea, but it doesn't have halachic relevance. And as I'm sure people know, this is next week's focus more. Rav Avadi Yosef, who came from Baghdad and was the successor to a world of very mystical Sephardi thinking, the world of the Chida, the world of the Ben Ish Chai, he broke with that very, very significantly and decided that with all respect to the world of Kabbalah, which he never for one minute belittled, God forbid, it has no place in halacha. And he spent his life really trying to filter out the Kabbalah from the halachic process, which won him lots of plaudits and won him lots of enemies. And in terms of how that works in halacha, we'll look at his approach next week. But today, what I want to do is as follows. We need to spend a few minutes talking about what is halacha, where does it come from, and what is Kabbalah, and where does that come from? And there are a few Pandora's boxes that we're going to open very slightly, if there's such a thing as a very small opening of Pandora's box. But we're going to look a little bit at the Zohar and the authenticity of the Zohar without coming to any conclusions either way, but we're just going to flag that a little. And then what I want to do is fairly systematically show you how the first 400 of years of this happened. From the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, how the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim adjusted to the reality of the Zohar and the Kabbalistic methodology. And next week we'll take it forward into the 19th and 20th century. Okay? And then we'll look at some specific issues. I want to look at Ayin Hara, which is a very interesting issue. I want to look at a few other Kabbalistic halachic issues occasionally that come up. So with that all for coming up soon, please, God. Let's have a look first of all now. We'll talk for a few minutes. You've got a sheet in front of you. The first couple of pages is English. I'm not going to read every line, but a few summaries. First of all, where does halacha come from? Now, forgive me if this is obvious to everybody, but it doesn't harm to go over it a little bit. We all, you know, relate to the world of halacha. We take it for granted. We look it up in a book. But where did it come from? Now, you're going to tell me it came from Sinai, of course. But there's a process of Torah Mi Sinai. The way halakha works today is basically, it's based on three things. Number one, canonical texts, and we have to decide which are the texts which are canonical, which we turn to as the bottom line for halakha. Number two, the weight of past authorities and case, if you like, law, based on the tshuvas of the last centuries. And three, the custom of Jewish practice, Minhag Yisrael. And these three things put together, and I brought you a reference to a very interesting shir by Rabbi Jonathan Ziering. Some of you probably know Rabbi Jonathan Ziering, fascinating Talmud Chochem, and he has a shir on this issue where he expands on this. But basically, there's this threefold structure. And different poskim give different weights to different elements of this. For example, the Orach HaShulchan is very well known for defending Minhag Yisrael. This is what Jews do, this is what the Frum community does. Even if it doesn't sound exactly from the books that this is how it should be, there has to be a way to justify it, because Minhag Yisrael is preeminent. Others, like I mentioned, Rav Avadya Yosef, put a lot of weight behind past authorities. If you read a tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef, he quotes at length from tshuvas and past precedents that most people have never even heard of the people who he's quoting from, and he quotes from them verbatim, and that's one of his major weights. Other people put a lot of emphasis on analyzing the classic texts. The Mishnah Brura, it's not uncommon that he will go through a new analysis of the Gemaras and Rishonim and say, look, this is what the halacha should be, based on the analysis. Our people don't do this. They should. They should do this. He obviously values Minhag Yisrael as well. But these three elements are extremely important and come into the halachic process. What are the canonical texts? Let's look at some of the basic, and you'll see why this is important when it comes to Kabbalah. Obviously, everything ultimately comes from the Tanakh. Everything comes from Nevuah, from the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu, from the Nevuah of Leiter Nevi'im, and when you look through Chazal, almost everything they do is either learnt out from a pasuk, from a verse, or connected back into a verse, through an asmata. But clearly, the main canonical text that we get halacha from is the Talmud. Which Talmud? The Talmud Bavli. The Talmud Bavli, the Gemara, and the Babylonian Talmud overrides pretty much everything else. Now, why? That's an interesting discussion in and of itself. What is the reason that the Bavli is preeminent, let's say, over the Yerushalmi? And I brought you in a footnote, there are different approaches to that. Either because it was mass, there was a mass acceptance by the Jewish people of the Bavli, or was it because there was a Yeridus Hadoros immediately after and we couldn't argue with it, or was it because it was later, and we paskin like the later over the earlier? But either way, the Talmud Bavli is our main canonical text. We also have the Talmud Yerushalmi, obviously, and different poskim give different weight to that. The Rambam, for example, is very well known for giving a lot of weight to the Yerushalmi. The Ashkenazi Rishonim, less so. In fact, there's a considerable debate as to whether the Ashkenazim, Rashi, knew much about the Yerushalmi at all. And there are different opinions on this. Some people say, really, they didn't have any access to it. And other people say, what are you talking about? A lot of the minhagim of Ashkenazi Jewry in the times of the 11th, 12th century were rooted in Minhag Eretz Yisrael from the Yerushalmi. You know, go and see Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's writings on this period and others. But the Yerushalmi has a role to play. But then there's other sources, the Tosefta, the Halachic Midrash, but the Bavli really is preeminent. That's the first point. The second point is, it's axiomatic in the halachic process that the Amoraim, the rabbis after the Mishnah in the Talmud, are subordinate to the Tanaim. They regard the Tanaim as authoritative. And again, exactly why that is, I'm not getting into now. You'll see why that's important in a minute. But the Tanaim beat the Amoraim in a contest, although the Amoraim obviously decide which ones to follow and how to understand them. It's also axiomatic that the Talmud was sealed. Meaning, after the Gemara, no one can argue on the Gemara. And we could have a whole shiur on why that is and how that happened, and I brought you a few footnotes. But that itself is axiomatic. No one can unpick the Gemara. The only people that can argue on the Gemara are a new Sanhedrin, which is another shiur as to whether we can get a new Sanhedrin and then start unpicking the Talmud. But until we have a new Sanhedrin, no one can argue on the Gemara. Now, of course, you're going to see in a minute, if we discover a source from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai that actually precedes the Gemara, then that argument becomes a little bit different, which we'll see very soon. Over the page, please. Into the Rishonim and Achronim. So, I think most people are familiar with the idea that after the Gemara, there are three basic strata. There's the Gaonim, who lived roughly 500 to 1050. the Rishonim, roughly 1050 to 1500, and the Achronim, roughly 1500 to present day. There is something of a debate as to whether we're still in the time of the Achronim, or whether we've turned over a new leaf and we're now in something else, which to some degree depends on your hashkafa in the world as to how you view the state of Israel, how you view the 20th century, but that, you know, that's another discussion. These things are not absolutely clear-cut. Nobody woke up one morning and said, "Ooh, yesterday I was a Rishon, today I'm an Acharon." It doesn't happen that way. There's a grey area. And at some point in the historical process, people look back and say, it's pretty clear now that things have changed. Now, there were dates like 1492, which were almost like an overnight shift in paradigm, yes, but it didn't usually happen that way. I'll give you an example. When is the end of the Rishonim for the Ashkenazim? And again, that's important because the Achronim, the later authorities, don't usually argue with the Rishonim. They're nervous to do so. When did that end? So people say, Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch basically is the line. He is the first of the Achronim, before him are the Rishonim. But it's not so poshut. It could be the Black Death was very important in 1350 in like drawing a line. People after that don't usually argue with people before. But generally speaking, Achronim do not argue with Rishonim. There are exceptions. The Vilna Gaon feels that he's happy to argue with anybody, all the way back to the Gemara. Others, even Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Ashkenazim were more, if you like, innovative in this than the Sfaradim in regarding these lines as a bit blurred. But basically there are those strata. And finally, before we get to the Kabbalah, there's the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, came along in the 1500s, in 1530, 1540, and said, look, everything is now very mixed up. We live in a post-expulsion reality. It's a kind of post-Holocaust feeling in the world. The Sfaradim have been exploded all around the world after 1492. The Ashkenazim have basically been relocated after going round and around and around France and Germany for 200 years, being thrown out from one little principality to the next. Eventually they found their way to Eastern Europe. Poland, Lithuania, Russia, places that really were pretty uncivilized at the time. The Lithuanians were still worshipping trees when the Jews arrived. But of course the Jews were happy to receive the Jews. People are always happy at the beginning, right? The first couple of hundred years, I tell my American students, I said the first 200 years are always great. Just look at history. Rabbi Wein said once, there are two constants in Jewish history. Number one is that history always repeats itself. And number two is that in every generation people say, yes, but this time it'll be different. Okay? They are the two constants in Jewish history. But anyway, so the Shulchan Aruch came along and said, look, we need a new system, we need a new psak, we don't have a clear Masorah anymore. A couple of hundred years before that, people lived in fixed places, in towns where they'd been for hundreds of years. Now everyone was everywhere. So he came up with this idea, we're going to have one psak for everybody, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, and exactly the methodology, how he paskened, I'm not getting into now, but that's what he produced. There were three reactions to the Shulchan Aruch. One was, this is the best thing since sliced bread. Well, I suppose the best thing until sliced bread. Okay? But this is fantastic. This is what we need. This is perfect. This has answered all our problems because it's given us a clear stack, basically like a Rambam, but Rif, Rosh, Rambam, whatever. We'll go forward with this. And the Sephardi world more or less accepted that as a great innovation. The second reaction was, this is great, but what about the Ashkenazim? They haven't really had a great look in. The Rambam obviously is ultra Sephardi. The Rif was Sephardi. And the Rosh was half-half. He's from Germany, but he lives in Spain. So there are a few that said, if we can just Ashkenazify the thing a little bit, then we can run with it. And that's what the Ramah did, as is well known. He put in Minhag Ashkenaz, a bit of Tosfos, a bit of the Maharam of Rothenburg, a bit of this, a bit of Maharil, etc., and then they went with it. And the third reaction is, this is a disaster. We can't have this. We can't have people looking up things in books and saying, that's the halacha, and the Maharshal is very clear on this, the Maharal of Prague is very clear on this, the Bach is very clear. So this is terrible. Now every single person, whether they're a Talmud Chacham or just an Amharic, can look it up and say, oh, I know how to paskin halacha. And they were very, very vociferous against it. The way to paskin halacha, said the Maharshal, is to become a Talmudic expert and learn through the whole of Shas, work out the answer for yourself, and come to a psak. And if you can't do that, then ask someone else who can. Don't look it up in a book. It was a kind of the art scrollification process of the 1500s. And people were very unhappy about it. Okay? Not that other people weren't very excited about it, like you can find reactions to the 20th century. Fine. So that's where halacha comes from. Again, that was a very brief, analysis, and we could spend another 30 sessions on that, but not for now. Where does Kabbalah come from? Well, and you'll see why we needed to ask the first question before we get to the second. Well, Jewish mysticism is as old as Judaism. If you look in the Tanakh itself, look in the Chumash, there are some deeply mystical episodes. Think of the burning bush. Think of the Moshe on top of Har Sinai, where Hashem is putting his hand over him and going past him and saying the Yud Gimel Midah. If that's not mystical, then what is? There's some deep mysticism all the way back to the beginning. And of course, traditional Kabbalah roots itself in the oral law at Sinai. That Kabbalah came through, received, that's one of the reasons it's called Kabbalah, all the way through the process from Torah Sinai. The Second Temple period was definitely mystical. The Book of Daniel, many of the apocryphal books, Jewish Gnosticism, there are all sorts of themes that the Jewish people were connected with, Babylonians, with the Hellenists, with the Persians. There's no question that mysticism was high on the agenda of many people. In the Gemara itself, Chazal talk about Ma'aseh Breshit and Ma'aseh Merkava as the classic Jewish mystical ideas of the secrets of creation, the secrets of the chariot, Yechezkel's vision of the Merkava. A walk in the paradise. What is the paradise? The word, of course, became the English word paradise, but the paradise is the orchard. Arba nichnasu l'paradise, the four that went in and only one came out whole and the others went either mad or died or became a heretic, etc. What is the paradise? Many will see that as part of the deep Kabbalah. After the Gemara, there's the whole, what they call less known, Heichalot literature. I don't know if people are familiar with this. This is not an area that I have any expertise in, but over the hundreds of years after the Talmud, you have this literature produced by the Gaonim, really, of rabbis ascending different levels of palaces through into Shamayim and reporting what they see and coming back down and going up. There's a lot of mysticism around. And then even before the Zohar becomes public, you have the Kabbalists of the Rishonim, the Ramban. The Ramban's commentary on Chumash is well known for being not only a pshat and a drash commentary, but a sod commentary. It is deeply Kabbalistic. There's always a question, do you translate, if there's an English translation of the Ramban, do you translate the Kabbalistic bits or do you not translate the Kabbalistic bits? Or do people know what they're talking about even if they read them, if they're not Kabbalistic? But the truth is the Ramban was deeply mystical. His Masorah was very much actually from the Ashkenazim. People don't always realize this. In the time of the Rishonim, it was the Ashkenazim that were the mystics and the Sfaradim that were the rationalists. And that flipped around at a certain point, but you have this Ashkenazi Masorah of the Pietists of Germany, the Hasidei Ashkenaz, Rav Yehuda HaChosid, etc. So Kabbalah and mysticism was very real. But then in the 1300s, the Zohar appeared. And that's really where we need to pick things up. Where did the Zohar come from? So that's a long story. One thing we know for sure is that Rav Moshe de Leon, who was a Rishon in Spain, a lesser known Rishon, but nevertheless one of the school of Kabbalistic thinkers, discovered a manuscript. This is the classic understanding of Orthodox Judaism, discovered a manuscript which he realized was a hidden manuscript from the time of the Tanaim, and therefore this book, the Zohar, an enormous book, 1700 pages of very complex Aramaic and deep Kabbalistic ideas. He revealed this as being the Zohar which had been underground until then. Some people question whether anyone of those who wanted to claim, well, maybe he wrote it. So one big question is, how could he possibly have written anything of that nature? The magnitude of the Zohar goes far beyond anything that one would expect that someone, even of the nature of Moshe de Leon, could write. But nevertheless, the Zohar was revealed, and it has many prescriptive statements. You can do this, but you can't do that, etc. And we have some questions to raise. If it's really from Rav Shimon bar Yochai, who is a Tana, does that mean that the Zohar now has authority over the Bavli? Because like I said to you before, the Amoraim deferred to the Tanaim, and here's a rediscovered Tana. So does that mean that he trumps the others? On the other hand, even other material from the Tanaim, like the Tosefta, doesn't always trump the Bavli, so maybe this doesn't either. What about the fact that it's Rabbi Shimon so what? Normally speaking, in the Gemara, if there's a machlokas between other people and Rabbi Shimon, who is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we don't paskin like Rabbi Shimon. In a lot of cases, not always, sometimes we do, but often we don't. Does that mean that we lower the authority a little bit? What impact does the fact that it was discovered later have on the process? Meaning, stuff that we discover after the period in which it was written, does it just appear on the scene and change everything? Or do we say, no, the fact that it was discovered later means it's a lower status. This is usually a classic discussion about the Meiri and people like that. The Meiri was discovered largely in the Vatican in 400-500 years after it was written. Do we turn around and say, great, now we have another source on the Rishonim, the Meiri, let's plug that in? Or do we say, no, the classic authorities didn't know about the Meiri, so we can't just bring in the Meiri. It's more of an acharon than a Rishon. Do we say that about the Zohar as well, because it was discovered later? And then, of course, there's the $64,000 question. Go over to page 3, which is the Zohar fully authentic? Do parts of it come from later periods? It's not all Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, or is it? Is it from the Amoraim? Is it from the Gaonim? Is it from the Rishonim? How are we going to do this? And if you just peep, just for a second, and I'm not going to go through this in detail, if you look at the back page, just turn to the back of the sheet, I brought you an appendix. I am not an authority on the Zohar in any sense at all. But I brought you 8 or 9 points to think about on the authenticity of the Zohar. Let's just talk about this for a second. Since the Zohar appeared, there have been people asking whether it was authentic or not, which is understandable, because when you discover a manuscript, there are always going to be people that say, this sounds a bit strange, how do we know? The classic opinion of the Orthodox world, and certainly of Kabbalah, is that the Zohar was written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. I actually have a funny story. I was given by the husband of an ex-student of mine a box of Svarim many years ago, which I just stuck in my basement. He says, I don't want it, I'm going back to Chutz-Laaretz, you take it. So I just put it in my machzan and forgot about it. And then one day I was going through my machzan and I thought, oh, I forgot, this is a box of Svarim, how amazing. I opened it up and it was a full set of Zohar translated into English. Well, that's amazing. But then I opened up the first page and it was translated by the Kabbalah Center in California. Yes. Yes. And then my heart sank. And then I realized why this guy had given me the Svarim. Okay? So I asked the Shaila, I shan't tell you who I asked, and I said, here we have a set of Zohar which was written by the Kabbalah Center, which is flaky to say the very least. Okay? And I said, what do I do with it? I said, I'm not that keen to keep it. So the person who I asked says, this is a sefer written by Afikorsim, you have to burn it. So I'm not into burning books, that doesn't sit well with me. But you know something? I asked the Shaila, that's what he said. I thought, I'd give it a go. Okay? So I went down into the Jerusalem forest and gave it a go. And you know something? One burn. It had a hex on it, you know? Or whatever it was. I said, look, I did what the Rav said. It won't burn. The only fire I could find that I thought would be big enough to burn the book was on Lag BaOmer. And I thought, if I start throwing the Zohar onto the fire at Lag BaOmer, then the next thing on the fire is going to be me. And I won't get the subtlety of the situation across to people. So I asked another Shaila to someone else and said, listen, I'm not into this book burning business. It doesn't sit well with me. And it won't burn anyway. So he said, just put it in the garbage bag and throw it in a dumpster in Haranoff and that'll be fine. Which is what I did. I don't know if anybody found it, if it's now recycled through someone else. But the Zohar, I can't remember how I even got into that, but the Zohar certainly has been accepted in almost the entire Torah world. Nevertheless, there have been people even within the Torah world who questioned the full authenticity, and this is relevant for us. Specifically Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden raised the question on the Zohar. He wrote a book, Mitachat Sfarim, where he questioned whether the whole thing was from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. We'll see Rav Yaakov Emden later did take the Zohar seriously. It's not that he didn't take it seriously. He quotes from it very respectfully, but he just raised the question. I'm not sure whether the whole thing is from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai or not. The Chida, later on, a couple of hundred years later, basically almost calls him a heretic for even questioning the authenticity of the Zohar. And the Chasam Sofer in Pressburg comes to the defense of the Rav Yaakov Emden and says, listen, Zelo Pashut, look at number 19 for a second, we're on the back page. Ilu hayecholet b'yad Adam lahamid midrashei Rashbi al taratam. If we could just filter out, if you like, the midrashim of Rashbi, the actual authentic ones, levarer mihem mimashen nitchaber aleihem mechachmei hadorot she'achrav. If we could just get rid of all the things in the Zohar which accreted later in other generations, lo yekul orak sefer katan hakamut ma'od machzik tapim mutim. It would only be a very small book. So the Chacham Sofer himself said that he takes the Zohar and Kabbalah seriously, but it's not all necessarily from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. So too, one of the main students of Rav the Noda Yehuda in number 20 in the Shadrach Shuvah Shuv Mi'ava. Aval ani oimer hareini nishba b'toyra Hashem. I am going to give you a. I'm going to make a shvuah. He says shebetseifa hazoah nimsu kama ziyufim. Now this obviously is not happy reading for the Kabbalists. Okay? But this is not an academic, this is one of the main gedolim of the 19th century. There are many things which are not authentic. V'kilkulim and mistakes, Hashem Otifu, that God added on. V'alei echad mi Talmud Bavli, one daf of the Talmud Bavli, a kodesh yoter mi kol sefer Zohar, is more kodesh than the whole of the book of the Zohar, he says. We'll see if that's relevant too. Lav gushpanka de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai va'azakte chatum aleim. This does not have the seal or the signet or ring of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. U'mi sheyesh lo chetzi das. Anyone with half a mind, he says, yagid kein will say that k'mavur b'sefer mipachad agon Rabbi Rav, and he quotes the Yavetz, etc. Okay. On the other hand, Rabbi Yaakov Emden is very eccentric. It is true, and he's not always right. And he also thought that the Moreh Nebuchim was a forgery as well, couldn't possibly be the work of the Rambam, which is not true. So just because he thinks something, it doesn't mean that it's always exactly correct. And I brought you some other sources. There's a very good series, or a long series of articles on Chabad.org. You can imagine which way they jump on this question. They're clearly, you know, defending and quoting some of the academic material, although that article has been criticized. I brought you a short clip by Rabbi Wein, which is always worth listening to anything Rabbi Wein says. And then the Maisa, most communities treat the Zohar as authentic. There are a few, the Dorodayim of the Yemenites are not into the Zohar, the Spanish and Portuguese are not into the Zohar. I think the modern Orthodox community also has an uncomfortable relationship with the Zohar. They tend to be a less enchanted and more rationalist thinking community, and the Zohar doesn't sit so easy. And at the end, I brought you some academic references. Obviously, if you want to get into an academic understanding, Gershom Scholem is the key 20th century starting point. You can get all of the stuff online, the origins of Kabbalah, etc. Rav Menachem Kasher, in the 1950s, wrote a very strong, academically strong defense of the Zohar, to Sholem's point. And Rav Kasher was a very strong academic as well as a massive Talmid Chacham. And you can get that online too. In modern times, Professor Moshe Eidel is one of the people that deals with this. And then I brought you at the very end an article by Mark Shapiro, who always has an interesting spin on anything, which is there an obligation to believe that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wrote the Zohar? You can read that and see what you make of that. But why do I care what the academics say? Meaning, there's all sorts of academic opinions on everything, on biblical criticism, and we don't tend to sort of deliberate on. The answer is because when it comes to the authenticity of the Torah, that is one of the axiomatic Yud Gimel Ikrit. There is an absolute religious imperative to commit to the principle of Torah Misina. One of the Yud Gimel Ikrit is not to believe in the authenticity of the Kabbalah, meaning you may be a fool if you don't, but there may be more of a discussion to be had with the academic to work out how that works. So all of these questions, I've gone on a bit too much at length. Let's get into some sources. All of these questions are relevant. And of course, post-Zohar, or post-revelation of the Zohar, Kabbalah's had an up-and-down history. It caught on very fast, and then there was the Shabtai Tzvi debacle, and then people got a bit nervous, to say the least, about Kabbalah, and then in the late 18th century came back with Hasidus, and the Lithuanians as well. That's all historical, which we're not going to look at now. So let's have a look now on page 3, and we're going to see some very, hopefully, interesting things. Let's start with some early voices. Yes?
Has the Zohar been translated into Hebrew, and if so, when?
Yes, you can get translations, or at least expositions in Hebrew of the Zohar. The Rav Ashlag, the Sulam, who was one of the main commentators on the Zohar from the 20th century, has an excellent commentary which puts a lot of it in Hebrew. And also there are modern Torah books of the Zohar which actually translate everything into Hebrew. You can also get it into English. You don't have to go to the Kabbalah Center.
The English translation that you would trust?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not good enough in the Zohar. I have no way of knowing whether the English translation is authentic or not. But there are academic English translations of the Zohar. There's a set of yellow books that you can buy. Also online you can get the Zohar in Hebrew as well. So it's not hard to find it in Hebrew. Fine. Let's look at number one. How do people react to the Zohar early days? We're going to take this systematically, go through, and see what happens. Let's start with the Mizrahi. Who is the Mizrahi? So Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi is well known for being a commentary on Rashi. But he also, in the 1400s, was one of the first people to deal with the Zohar. Number one, the law is Zobil that. Not just this. Elakol Dava Vadava Shalom Huska Loi B'Talmud Bavli, the Loi B'Talmud Yerushalmi. Anything that we don't find in the Bavli and Yerushalmi. The Loi Dibra Boya Poskim Hashem Yipiyim Anu Chaim, V'Alei Manu Tzonchim, Koli Inyani Hadad Bechlal. And on the classic regular posting, Torah Tanigla. Anything that we don't find in the Bavli Yerushalmi posting, which is our go-to place for halacha, ein anu yicholim lahachriach bo, we can't force anyone to take those other things on that are not in the classic posting. Afal pi shebali kabbalah dibru bo, even though the Bavli Kabbalah were into it. We can't force people. Why? Mipnei shedivrehem einam ela al sad haremez, because the Kabbalah is talking in hints and parables. Shemaramzim heim la'atzmam, and they know what they're talking. It's a whole different language, which of course is fundamental. If you're trying to communicate something which is metaphysical beyond the world of the physical that we live in, you need to work out a new kind of language to communicate that. You can't just use your regular language. So Zohar and Kabbalah is a whole different language of communication. And they knew what they were talking about. Aval bizmanenu, he's in the 1400s. In our days, he says, Zeb avonat harab, for our many sins, ein anu mechavnim betzvilaseinu laharmiz b'masheroi laharmiz. We can't daven the way that the Kabbalists say we have to daven. In all these kavanas in davening, we're not up to that. Halavai she'ainu mechavatim al pshat divareinu hayotzim mipinu. Halavai, we even knew what we were talking about at all when we davened. This is not a new phenomenon. This is 600 years ago nearly. And he's saying that forget about kavanas. We just need to work out what we're basically saying. We just can't get regular people involved. We can't force them to start focusing on Kabbalistic things, which are all very lofty. We don't find any of the Kabbalim which insist on that. Things that the Talmud didn't talk about may be very true, may be very beautiful, but we don't really know what they mean if we're not big Kabbalists, and therefore we can just put them to one side, he says. They're not bad, but we can't force anybody to involve themselves in it. So too, the Radvaz, who is a contemporary, just a little bit later, he is dealing with one of the many questions of tefillin. Tefillin seems to be the battleground between Kabbalah and Halacha on many of these issues. He's dealing with the minhag of taking tefillin off on Rosh Chodesh davening for Musaf, which I'm sure everybody here who wears tefillin, which I assume is the men, but I'm not making any assumption, okay? Anybody here who is there to go on davening will take their tefillin off for Rosh Chodesh, for Musaf. Why? Why do you do that? Why do we do that? That doesn't appear anywhere in the Gemara. On the contrary, it sounds very much from the Gemara that you should be wearing your tefillin all day, every day. Forget about taking them off for this, you should be wearing them all the time. So it says the Radvaz, Shaila. Says, Alma samcho ha'olam lachlot ha'tefillin b'tefillat musaf Rosh Chodesh. Why are we taking our tefillin off on Rosh Chodesh for Musaf? This is in the 1500s. Javazel lo nimsa b'gemara v'loi b'poskim nimsa metzleinu. We don't find this halacha in the Gemara or the poskim, but nimsa b'seife al-kana, it's in this other seife al-kana, al-mitzvah v'alav samcho, this is what everyone's relying on. Benagu kulam lachlot ha'tefillin, everyone takes off their tefillin. The afal pisha einam yodin ta'amo, nobody really knows why, he says. And the cave Sharul and Mikta Samit asking the Sifri Kabbalah. Since people saw this in the Kabbalah, Shechol Simotam, that the Kabbalah says to take them off. Gam heim oisim keim mitzvah sanashim ulumuda kehilchus abaloi kaiva. Everybody takes them off, even though they don't know why. And it's like something that everybody does, but they don't really know why they do it. It's because of the Mekubalim. The gamma ani noeg lechlot. I also take my tefillin off, says the Radbaz. Shiraiti al sefer. I've seen the book. The matter al adava, and I've upheld this matter. The fisha yesh bidei klal gadol v'chol davar shenichtav gemara. But I want to give you a klal. Anything in the gemara or be'echad min apoyskim or bali alochas afilu shiyu hefech mimashakos b'sifri kabbalah, that if there is something in the kabbalah which goes against, which contradicts the classic halacha, I will go with the halacha and not with the Kabbalah. Last me, for myself, he said, imhu chumra. If there's a chumra, and we'll see this is very important because it comes out later. If there's a chumra in the Kabbalah, something extra, then I'll take that on. Why not? The imkula, but if it's a leniency, then I won't look at it because I'm not going to take Kabbalah against halacha in order to break halacha. But if it's extra, then why not? The imtam, and if you say that he wants to say, really, aren't we meant to wear our tefillin all day anyway, so surely he does go against the halacha to take off your tefillin for Rosh Chodesh Musaf. He says, no, we take our tefillin off for the slightest reason, and therefore to take them off for 15 minutes earlier is neither here nor there, and it's fine. And therefore he says, I won't tell anybody else, just look at the last words, Mikol Mokam, Ein Ani Moira La'adam Lachlot, I don't tell people what to do on this matter. It's up to them. As far as I'm concerned, the halacha says you can leave them on for Musa. But if people want to take them off, even though they don't really know why they're doing it, fine, let them take them off. It's a chumrah according to Kabbalah. Now, it's interesting, if you kept your tefillin on for Musa today, I'm sure there'd be a lot of people checking, you know, saying, take your tefillin off, we don't wear tefillin for Musa. Okay, that's the Minhag Yisrael. Anyone ever seen people keep their tefillin on for Musa? For Rosh Chodesh, never. So that's definitely the Minhag Yisrael, and I'm sure that's the halacha. But you see, on this early discussion, halacha versus Kabbalah, he came out with two clear rules. Number one, if it contradicts halacha, we're not going to go with Kabbalah. And number two, if it's a chumrah, then why not? But he's not going to force anyone. Okay, over the page. The big player when it came to this question was the Bet Yosef. Now I mentioned the Bet Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo wrote the Shulchan Aruch. But he wrote his magnum opus, the Bet Yosef, earlier. And what he does is he gathers all of the different opinions of the Rishonim together. And he says, I'm going to come to a hachra, a pshara between them. And he's going to pass in halacha. It was finished in the 1540s. And it was printed by the mid to late 1500s, which was very important. Because the only printing press in Eretz Yisrael was in Tzfat, just down the road from where Rav Yosef Karo lived. So this was the first book, really, that within a few decades of it having been written, was on the desk of every Rav all around Europe. So it made a big impact, because printing itself was only invented not long before this. So if you look here briefly in his introduction to the Bet Yosef, in number 3, top of page 4, he tells you what are his sources. Nimsa. Shemisha yiyah sefer zeh lefanav. If you've got my book in front of you, he says, yes, sedurim lefanav, you'll have organized in front of your eyes. Then he goes through a list of 31 different collected Rishonim that he's brought together. Starting with Divrei Talmud, Al-Perish Rashi, Atosfas, Haran, Piskei Harif, etc., etc., etc. Not going to read everyone. He lists them to show what he's been researching. And then at the end he says, U'b'ktsat mukomot mamari hazemar. And I'm also going to sprinkle in every now and then some statements of the Zohar. Now that's a big deal. The Bet Yosef was the first person to say that the Zohar is going to have a significant impact. Not major. He quotes the Zohar just over 100 times in the Bet Yosef, which given the size of the book is not that many, if you think how many times he quotes everybody else. But nevertheless, he says the Zohar is going to come in. Now, what was his agenda? He doesn't put the Zohar in a lot, but the Bet Yosef also wrote another book called the Magid Meisharim. What is the Magid Meisharim? The Magid Meisharim is an account, is his diary of his discussions with the Magid. I think it's well known that Rav Bet Yosef was a deep Kabbalist, and he had a lifelong conversation with this voice, this prophetic voice that came to him al pi Ruach HaKodesh when he was learning Mishnayot, and this was his Magid, which spoke to him and told him, you know, how to move ahead with his life, gave him encouragement, gave him tochacha, etc. And this book was published under the title of Magid Meisharim. It's really very interesting. I once got myself into the Bet Yosef's house. It's not usually on the normal tourist trail. I didn't go to the Bet Yosef shul, but I had a tour guide that said, I've got the keys for the Bet Yosef's house. Do you want to pop in? So I said, well, why not? As long as I'm invited. I don't want to, you know, go uninvited. We went into the Bet Yosef's house, and there in the corner of the house, there's a little cave where he sat and learned Mishnayot and had a conversation with the Maggid. Okay, this voice. I sat in the cave with a few of my students, and we learned a few Mishnayot. I didn't hear any voices, but that's because I'm Jimmy, and he's the Bet Yosef, and he writes in the Bet Yosef, in the Maggid Meshorim as follows, number 4. Ulechein, chazak v'amat v'toratecha. This is the voice, this is the Maggid talking to him. Chazak v'amat, he says. Kasha ata oisi b'toro u'mishno b'gemara rashi toisvet. You're doing all these great things with all the Torah, u'psak, and with psak, u'b'kabbalah, and with Kabbalah, ki atar m'kasher otam zebazeh. You're trying to connect all of these things together. And all of the angels wish you well and say this is an excellent thing to try and combine in some way halacha and Kabbalah. So you see that deep down this was something of an agenda that he wanted to try and develop. And if you look, I brought you in the footnotes some other places in the Maggid Meisharim where he brings halachic issues and he brings deep Kabbalistic ideas in them as well. But in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't make a massive impact, but it does in some places. And one of the key areas is the following. When you get called up for an aliyah, if a man gets called up for an aliyah, does he read quietly along with the Baal Kaira? Or does he stay silent? What do people do? Right, so you probably can't hear them if you're sitting out the back, but they read along. They read along. If they know how to read, they read. If they don't, I suppose they don't. Usually they read it wrong, I'm sure. But they read. They read along. But what's the problem with that? Well,
they move their lips and say it.
Yes. They're hopefully saying something approximating to the actual thing that the Baal Kaira... Okay. It's not so hard, but it's not so easy either. So if you look at what the Bet Yosef says is as follows. Number 5. U'mitach lashon harosh. If you look in the Rosh, Shekasev Rabbeinu, okay, Yitzvar lecha, it'll be clear to you, Shitzarech ha'oyle likrot benachat. You have to read quietly, Im shliach tzibur, Kidei shelo tehei birkato lebatala. What's the deal? The Gemara doesn't talk about this. Why not? Because then there wasn't such a thing as a Baal Kaira. Everybody who got called up read their own portion. And this is what they do in a Yemenite shul. One of my friends was called up in a Taimani shul for an aliyah. So he stood up and he made his brochas and he looked around and there was no one else there. So he went, no. So he went, yeah. So they kind of rolled their eyes and they called some kid from the back who came up and he just read all of the stuff. Okay? So the Gemara doesn't deal with it because it wasn't, but by the time of the Rishonim, you had a professional Baal Kaira. And says the Rosh, if this man makes a bracha but reads nothing, it's a bracha levatala. He's making a bracha on reading the Torah, but he's decided not to read. He's got to read something. He can't just stay quiet. V'Rabbeinu Hagadol Moreinu Rav Abuhav, but then he quotes the Abuhav, okay? Kasav Shamati Shekasav B'Sefer HaZohar She'ein Likrot Klal. The Zohar says, you better not read. Ela Echad, only one person, V'Roy Lachush L'Dvarav, and you better follow the Zohar. It's very dangerous, Kabbalistically, it's very negative if two people are reading the Torah at the same time. Now again, don't ask me why, because ask your local Orthodox Kabbalist. But it's bad. So what are we going to do? So now you've got to choose. You can't fudge it, really, because either you do read or you don't read. The Rosh says if you don't read, then you're making a bracha for nothing. And the Zohar says if you do read, you're doing bad things. The Kevan Shel Dibrei HaZohar Asur Likrot El Echad. Since the Zohar says only one person can read about. The Achshav Shenagu Shliach Tzibur Hu Akareh. Now the Shliach Tzibur is the one who reads. Okay? Ha'oile Asur Likrot Afal Pishe De Dibrei HaPoskim Tzarich Likrot. So the Poskim say he has to read. The Zohar says he can't read. Ve'im Lo Yikri Kasev Dehavi Brocha Levatola. Now, says the, listen to the Bet Yosef. He says, this is not mentioned specifically in the Talmud. The Gemara doesn't say you have to read. The Poskim, the Rishonim, the Rosh, says you have to read, and others. It's not in the Talmud Behedya. Loi shavkinan divrei hazohar mipnei divrei haposkim. Oh, this is new. We're not going to ignore the Zohar when the Zohar conflicts with the Poskim. If the Zohar conflicts with the Talmud, we'll go with the Talmud. Because the Talmud has priority. But when the Talmud doesn't say anything and the Zohar says do X, but the Poskim, Rashi, Rambam, Rosh says do Y, we're going to go with the Zohar. That's very interesting. And then he says maybe you could make harmonize them and bring them together, which is nice if you can. And of course he wants to try and do that. But given a conflict between the Zohar and the classic poskim, he's gone with the Zohar. And another area where this comes in, and this is a classic, is tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Now, even to our day, there is something of an ongoing discussion about this. I, when I first came from Chutz La'aretz, had never really heard of not wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. It says clearly the Shulchan Aruch to wear, the Ramah, rather, to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed without a bracha. Okay, maybe even with a bracha, depending on, you know, who you paskin like. But tefillin, why shouldn't you wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed? Because it's not a day of, it depends on how you view Chol HaMoed. So Shabbat, you can't wear tefillin because Shabbat is an otz, otzili olam, and tefillin is an otz, and you can't have the sign of the symbol of tefillin conflicting with the symbol of Shabbat, Chol HaMoed Goreya, they're gonna kind of do bad things with each other. So you don't wear tefillin. But what's with Chol HaMoed? Is it Chol? In which case, of course, you wear tefillin. Or is it Mikra Kodesh, which it kind of is as well, in which case you don't wear tefillin. So the halacha clearly was that you do wear tefillin. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, I sat in Chovav Eitz Zion, round the corner here, Chol HaMoed Pesach, and put my tefillin on. They didn't look at me. They threw me out! He came up to me, the Gava, verkocht. Yeah, and he said to me, if you want to wear your tefillin, you put them on in your hotel room, you put them on at home, you don't bring them into shul. And he was like, if people are like, you know, the minhag Eretz Yisrael is not to wear tefillin Chol HaMoed. And if you want, what's that? You had a different experience.
Yeah, I was asking
for
my bar mitzvah that day.
He was asking if it was your bar mitzvah that day. You put them on for the first time. A little sarcastic perhaps, but nevertheless, the point was clear. So let's see what the Bet Yosef does with this question. Number six. The Achshav Nagu Kol B'nei Sfarad, Shaloi La'anichem B'Chol HaMoed. He writes that the minhag in Spain is not to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Now, he's already after the expulsion, but he's only one generation after. He was a little boy. He was 4 years old when he was expelled from Spain. So he knows the minhagim of Spain. He's living in a community full of Spanish expellees, refugees. Expats. So the minhag is not to wear tefillin, is not to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Now, for Shamati, and I heard, he's going to let you in on an interesting historical progression. Shemikaidem, it used to be the minhag, hayumanichim otam, that the Svarim did wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Kedivrei HaRosh, like the Rosh. The achakach matzu shikasa Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, and then they discovered that Reb Shimon Bar Yochai says the Mama Echad in one of his statements in the Zohar she also lahanichem b'chol hamoed that you can't. The alkein nimru milahanichem b'chol hamoed, and they changed the minhag. You tried getting Sfarim to change their minhag. The Zohar did it. They used to wear their tefillin chol hamoed in the 1400s. Came along the Zohar and they changed their minhag, and now they don't wear tefillin. He says. And if you don't believe me, this is what my uncle, and he lived in Spain, this is what he writes, Beit HaTshuva. The Hamamar Hahu is the Midrash Anel and Shir Hashirim. He quotes where the Zohar talks about this. And again, he says, since it's not clear exactly in our Gemara that you have to wear tefillin, meaning the Gemara is not clear on this. So what's his rule? If it's not clearly in violation of the Gemara, then you should do it. Mi yarev liboy lageshet lavor bekum ba'afei al divrei Shimon Bar Yochai. Who is going to mess with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai? Who is going to wear tefillin in contravention of the Zohar? Hamaflik kol kach be'isah hanachasan. Who is so explicit and so clear about the problem of wearing them? We're not messing with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. We're not, and therefore the minag. The minhag changed, which is really very interesting. If you go over the page, one last source, the Bet Yosef deals with the question of one bracha on tefillin or two brachas on tefillin. Again, something which we kind of made a little bit of a pshara on. When you wear tefillin, there's two tefillin, obviously. There's the arm tefillin, there's the head tefillin. So what bracha do you make? Lahaniach tefillin. So do you make a second bracha on the head tefillin? So Ashkenazim do, and Sfaradim do not. Okay, Ashkenazi make al mitzvah tefillin, and then they put them on and say Baruch Shem Kavod Machatoli Olam Va'ed. Kind of to hedge the bets a little bit. That's what you say when you make a bracha that you shouldn't make, and it's a bit strange because you make the bracha and then you say Baruch Shem Kavod. But The Bet Yosef deals with this question, and there are those who are very surprised at how can you go against the Zohar, which is very clear, one bracha and one bracha only. And here he comes down the other way. He says, no, the Gemara says to make two brachas, so we'll go with the Gemara. It's very consistent. But the Gemara says to do something clearly, he's going to go with the Gemara over the Zohar, so he says we make two brachot, which is interesting, because again, Sfaradim often make one bracha, but there he goes with the Gemara over the Zohar. And I brought you some interesting examples, just a few, and we'll deal with more next week, of where the Zohar has crept into the Bet Yosef. For example, Levim washing the hands of Kohanim before Duchening, as opposed to anybody else. I'm a Bechor. Every now and then I get in on the action, and I'm a kind of lazy for a day, yeah? But, you know, I feel a bit, like, badly dealt because my mother is a bad lady, so I'm almost there, you know? But you know, that doesn't help me. So the Levim washing the hands of the Kohanim lifting the right hand above the left hand, women not attending funerals, that's a psak of the Zohar, which has made it into the halacha there, washing your hands three times in the morning, that's part, rather as opposed to just a washing to prepare for davening, the arrangement of windows in a shul. These are just a few of the areas where the Zohar has been paskened by the Bet Yosef. In other areas, he doesn't. For example, according to the halacha, you can get a benefit from the Gid HaNasha. The Zohar says you shouldn't. The Bet Yosef says you can. It's fine. The halacha says you can. And a very interesting one, the Zohar says if you eat meat and you eat milk in the same hour, it doesn't matter which way round you do it, then that is not just bad, that's terrible. And the Zohar says all sorts of really scary things about if you did this and then you conceived a child within 30 days afterwards, the child gets neshama from the Sitra Achra and this and that. And like people, interestingly, do we follow this Zohar or not? So the Bet Yosef is insistent that if you eat milk, if you drink milk, there is no reason for you to be machmer and not have meat within the hour after. And that's, I think, how people practice, right? They can have milk, you can have, okay, hard cheese is a different question maybe, but you can, you know, bench and wash your hands and then you can eat meat straight away. What about the other way around? So the Sfaradim didn't have a question anyway because they wait 6 hours based on the Rambam. So the Zohar didn't add. But the Ashkenazim were then in a big, big problem. Because the Ashkenazim minhag in many places in the Rishonim, they didn't wait at all. It's just they didn't eat milk and meat in the same meal. But if they had meat, they would wash their hands, bench, wash out their mouth, clear the table, and they'd have cheesecake straight after, 5 minutes later. That was the minute. They didn't keep 1 hour. They started keeping 1 hour because of the Zohar. And the Ramah says that we used to wait 0 minutes. We just used to clean our hands, clean our mouth, bench, clear the table. But then we saw the Zohar and we were like scared and then we started with an hour. That's how the Ashkenazim started keeping 1 hour, based on the Zohar. And then, of course, they went on from there to keep whatever they keep now. But it's interesting that that's how it works. Fine. Let's go on. So the Bet Yosef has some very clear rules. What was the Ashkenazi response? Let's pull some of these ideas out. So the Ramah disagrees. The Ramah says in number 8, I don't agree that the Zohar versus the Poskim, the Zohar wins. I think the Poskim win. The Ein Lazuz Midivrei HaPoskim. I don't think you should leave the classic Poskim number 8. Af Im Hayu Divrei Zohar Cholkim Aleim. Even if the Zohar disagrees with them. V'chein Nirali. This is again in the question of one or two people reading from the Sefer Torah. Nirali Kalaika Beit Yosef. I don't agree with the Beit Yosef Shekatav Daloi Shokin and Divrei HaZohar. He says we can't leave the Zohar. Mipnei Divrei HaPoskim. So the Ramah comes out as an Ashkenazi less in favor of the Zohar. He says not only does the Talmud trump the Zohar, but the Poskim also trump the Zohar. Given a clash between the classic Poskim and the Zohar, we're going to go with the Poskim. The Maharshal also says, the Maharshal is a very fiery writer. He's a very harif person, and he says, even though he himself was respectful of Kabbalah, on dealing with the question of whether you put your tefillin on standing up or sitting down. That's another question. The Ashkenazim put them on standing up. The Sfaradim, half-half, right? It's the Shal Yad sitting down, the Shal Rosh standing up. And this was, again, one of the battlegrounds. And he says here, if you look here, Shasha'al Ta'ati al Minhagim le'anich tzvil and Shal Yad b'yeshiva o ba'amida. Chadashim mikarov ba'u v'roisim le'yot mikata mekubalim. There's all of these newfound Kabbalists, neo-Kabbalists, he says. U'midrashi ane'alamim u'chalishi arat, and they don't really know what they're talking about. Lo yabitu b'or ha-Zohar. They haven't really looked in the Zohar. V'lo yadu mozdo b'mo. They can't understand the Zohar, but kavanato, or what it means. Eleshekach matzu b'sifer Reb Shimon Bar Yochai. They just quote Reb Shimon Bar Yochai. This is a theme of the Maharshal. He hates it when people are just quoting from books and they're not Talmidei Chachamim. He says this in other places. And he says here, V'dahuvi, he says, you my dear one, he says, no, Shekol Rabotai V'Avotai HaKadoshim Sheshimshu Ga'oine Olam. I'm not coming from nowhere, he says. My rabbis were the greatest of the greats. Ra'iti Mehem Shaloi Nagukach. That's not, they didn't follow these Kabbalistic ideas. Ele Kedivri HaTalm V'Apoiskim. V'im Haya Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Oimed Lifaneinu. Even if Rav Shimon Bar Yochai got up in our Bet Midrash in front of us, but Saveich L'Shanot HaMinag and screamed at us to change the Minag, Shenagu HaKadmonim, Loi Ashkachinam Bein. I would just turn around and ignore it. Okay? Strong words. Strong words. Others were less strident. In number 10, I brought you a source, also Ashkenazi, that says, no, absolutely the opposite, that the Zohar is worth everything else almost put together. Look at the end of the first line of number 10. This is one of the students of the Marshal. He says, "Im yi yu kol ha-mechabrim v'kach mosnaim echad." If all of the poskim were on one side of the scales, the sefer ha-zohar levado yale v'kach ha-shvia, and the sefer zohar was on the other side, machriya et kulam. The zohar would outweigh all of them. So you see that there's, like with the Ashkenazim, a little bit of a lack of clarity. Individually, but there's no agreement as to quite how far to take it. Let's look at a couple of other things, and then we will finish for today. The Magen Avraham sets up a rule, which actually I'm going to leave for now, because it really is the Mishnah Berurah picks it up, and we'll see it next week. We'll bring this Magen Avraham next week. But I just wanted to mention Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who I mentioned at the beginning, felt that he wasn't sure the Zohar was entirely from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. If you read number 12 in your own time, you'll see that he does give it a lot of authority. He says that we should try and follow the Zohar wherever we can. Why not? It's a very holy book. And if we can make it fit with the Halacha, we should try to do that as well. So people often quote sound bites on these issues. Oh, Rabbi Yaakov Emden was against the Zohar. Lo nachon, that's not true. He expressed reservations about certain aspects of the text, but in terms of the Zohar, he was not against it at all. But I want to finish with the Chasam Sofer just for today. Maybe have a word about the Arizal, and then we'll be where we need to be. The Chasam Sofer was an Ashkenazi, obviously. He lived in Hungary. And he was nervous about Kabbalistic issues on some coming into the Halacha. And he writes the following on Shiluach HaKan. What's Shiluach HaKan? Chasing away the mother bird. So what does the halacha say? If you find the mother bird, and if you need the eggs, you chase away the mother bird, you take the eggs to eat. Okay? But should you be running around the countryside looking for birds and eggs to do the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen? No, why? Why would you? It might be wrong. It might be Tsar Bali Chaim going around, pushing all these birds around and taking the eggs and eating the chicks. And it's interesting. Do you find that people go out of their way to do this mitzvah? Some people do. So look at what the Chasam Sofer says. I'm not. But Chuvas Chavetz Yai, he quotes the Chavetz Yai, number 13. Siem Tam B'Shem Sefer Zohar. He brings this Zohar. B'Shiluach Ha'em. Why do we send away the mother bird? L'orer Yelalat Ha'imei Ilah Albameh. The screaming of the mother bird arouses the crying of the Shechina, the mother, if you like, for her children. And therefore what you're doing is you're achieving an incredible thing in the olamas, that in Cain mitzvah la'adar achakein, you have to go and find a bird's nest. Kedel ore rachmei ima eloi albaneh. Why wouldn't you want to do what you can to get the Shechina to cry over her children, bring us back to Geula? Well, if he's there, leke misha machzariyus, and therefore, of course, you wouldn't be worried about cruelty to animals, would you? Da'afilu im letzarich hanat adam. If you kill animals to eat them, we're not worried about the fact that they're not particularly happy about that. Because you can't tzarich mitzvah, you definitely kill an animal to do a mitzvah. So why are you worried? Go away and find a mother bird and do this. Says the Chasam Sofer, ach, shas dilan al kochach loitzirleh. But that's not how the Gemara paskens. That's not what we do. V'yadua, and we know heichi de pligi hanigle imanista, where there is a machlokas between the revealed and the hidden Torah, ein lanu esek benistaros v'niglos lanu levenein. We only go with the revealed and not with the hidden. And indeed, he says, he feels there's a danger to it. Look at this rather witty and pithy comment. The Chasam Sofer is often quoted because he has the best one-liners, okay, that people remember for a long time. And here's a great one, number 14. He says, v'chein ani oimer, kol ha-ma'arev divrei kabbalah im ha-alochas, for ha-psukos, if you try and mix kabbalah with regular halacha, chayiv mishum zoreya kilayim. That is a forbidden admixture. Pen tukdash hamalei'a zera ashet izra. And he quotes the pasuk. Pen tukdash means you're going to have to burn it because it's actually, a forbidden mixture. But also, tukdash is like a play on kodesh. You try to be too holy, you've mixed something that shouldn't be mixed. But then he says, and by contrast, hama'arif sipre higayon im divrei Torah. If you try and mix philosophy with Torah, ayve al chayresh shor v'chamor. Now you are plowing with a cow, with an ox and a donkey. And philosophy is the chamor, obviously. So he doesn't like any of those mixtures, and that's the problem. Just one word and we'll finish. The Ari is a whole different question, which is the Arizal in the 16th century was the lens through whom the Zohar was then seen. And we're going to have to pick this up. We'll start with this next time, which is how now going forward from the 16th, 17th, 18th century, how do we view the Arizal? How do we view the Zohar? The Chidah was a major, major supporter of the Arizal and the Kabbalistic Torah. And as I mentioned to you before, the Sfaradim have had to grapple with this a little bit over the last 300 or 400 years, and Rav Avadi Yosef has a very specific position. So what we're going to look at next week, please God, is we're going to look at the 19th and 20th century, the Kafa Chaim, the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Mishnah Berurah, Rav Avadi Yosef, and then we'll start giving some examples of how this plays out. So hopefully this is something which is of interest, but I certainly find it fascinating. Next week we'll go further, please God.